we have to be very, very careful. What we're talking is not so much democracy, we're talking organised hypocrisy. Hard facts.
Get back! Somebody's under fire.
The values our Parliament represents: democracy, freedom, human rights, the rule of law, command the admiration and respect of free people everywhere. That is why it is a target for those who reject those values. But let me make it clear today, as I have had cause to do before, any attempt to defeat those values through violence and terror is doomed to failure.
5 dead, including 1 police officer, with 40 injured, 7 of them seriously. This is the human toll of yet another terrorist atrocity to be unleashed in the streets of a major European city, on this occasion, London. The banal regularity with which these attacks now take place should in no way be allowed to minimise their impact on multicultural societies where millions of people of all faiths and none live cheek by jowl and have done for decades. The risk that the fabric of these societies may be ruptured, if not in time ripped apart, is a pressing one, and every effort must be made by politicians, religious leaders, the media and all people of goodwill to ensure that it does not happen. But sadly, we have now come to accept that these attacks are a matter of when and not if. Despite the security measures and efforts expended by police and intelligence services to prevent them. And by now, predictably, whenever such attacks do erupt, political leaders and establishment voices rally round with the same tired platitudes, assuring the public that we will not be defeated by terrorism, that those responsible for these deranged attacks hate our freedoms, and the fact that we live in open, multicultural societies. Well, if this is true, it's only part of the story. The individual, or indeed individuals as it may turn out, responsible for the attack in London was an alienated human being who sought and found meaning in a sick, perverted ideology, one that values death more than life and which holds at its heart a Manichaean worldview in which modernity and Islam are deemed incompatible. However, as I say, this is only one side of a two-sided coin, which is where we come to the heart of the matter. For this sick and dangerous ideology of religious extremism and fundamentalism is, in the last analysis, the product of the even more dangerous ideology of Western regime change. The idea that you can set fire to countries in the Middle East, collapse their societies, traumatise entire populations, sowing carnage and chaos on a biblical scale, and not expect any reaction in the form of blowback, well, this is utterly insane. And when British Prime Minister Theresa May, along with members of her cabinet, regale the British people with Churchillian rhetoric about fighting terrorism, they really do insult those who actually have been and are fighting terrorism, and yet have been consistently demonised by the British, French and US governments in the process. I'm talking here about Syria, Iran and Russia. These are the countries that are in the front lines resisting this menace in the Middle East. But rather than offer support or assistance to them in this struggle against an ideology that is an equal opportunities menace, the West has been doing its utmost to impede and undermine their efforts. Let me put it another way. Rather than deploying hundreds of British troops to Estonia to keep Russia in check, as the British government did in the same week that this latest terrorist atrocity took place, imagine if those troops instead had been deployed to Syria as part of a multinational effort alongside their Syrian, Russian, Iranian and US counterparts to destroy Daesh, Nusra and various other Salafi jihadi groups. And just imagine how much further we would be in that objective as a result. But in the meantime, while we are waiting for such a world to materialise, perhaps Western governments may wish to consider asking Saudi Arabia's King Salman a few questions the next time he deigns to pay them a visit. I'm thinking here specifically questions concerning the role of Saudi state-funded Wahhabi preachers in spreading a message of religious extremism and sectarianism to the faithful. questions concerning their fixation with slaughtering infidels and apostates until our leaders and governments are prepared to ask these questions, and even more importantly, are prepared to take action according to the answers they received, then they cannot be taken seriously when it comes to combating terrorism. I'm John White, and this is Hard Facts. Well, joining me to pick over this issue, I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. David Lowe of Liverpool John Moores University. Dr. Lowe is an expert on terrorism who advises and assists a number of UK police forces with their counter-terrorism strategy. Dr. Lowe, welcome to the show.
Thanks, John.
Now, this attack comes 4 years after the last major terrorist attack. Again, it was in London. It was the murder of Lee Rigby, the British soldier, close to his barracks in Greenwich, by two individuals who, as in the case with this terrorist attack, they used a car to run him down, and then they proceeded to butcher him with, in this case, knives and machetes. Now, there's no way we can stop these attacks, is there, David? I mean, these attacks are so unsophisticated. These so-called lone wolves, they seem to be able to slip off the security and counter-terrorism radar. Despite all the efforts and resources, which I completely accept have been extraordinary, given that we've only had two such attacks in 4 years, many might say one is one too many, but in comparison to other countries in Europe, there's no way we can stop these attacks completely, is there?
No, this is the nightmare scenario, is this lone actor who carries out this low-level attack. And you sort of see the echoes of Al-Adnani. He was a chief spokesman for Daesh, who was killed last year in a drone attack. He gave out that fatwa in 2014. And it was saying, pick up, you know, sharply bladed instruments like knives and attack people, get in a vehicle, drive into crowds, get a stone people and so on. And certainly if no one is on a system or being watched, it's so difficult. I mean, Massoud, yes, he has a criminal record, but it's coming out that there was no evidence so far or intelligence that he was connected with any group. And it's the more information that's coming out today, this is becoming true, that he's acted on his own initiative. And this is the nightmare scenario. And of course, unfortunately, we've witnessed it not just in the UK. We saw it in France last year, Nice and so on, you know, all around the world. This is really difficult to pick up.
Now, given that you're an insider in terms of counter-terrorism strategy and operations, do we have a handle on this? Or are there real gaps in our intelligence and our understanding on our ability to penetrate these networks before these attacks take place? Obviously, we're looking at a proactive counter-terrorism strategy to try and interdict before these attacks can take place. But I believe Massoud was on the radar of counter-terrorism around 2010, but he slipped off, or it was felt at the time that he was no longer a risk or a danger. Do you think this is cause for serious questions to be asked?
Well, no, we have to realise the amount of resources available to this, and there's risk assessments being carried out all the time. You know, you mentioned Lee Rigby before, and Adebo Woli and Adebo Larji were on the system, but they were deemed as dormant. I mean, there was another issue that cropped up in the parliamentary investigations of the killing of Lee Rigby, that Adebo Woli had been in touch with someone from Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula on Facebook Messenger about killing a British soldier on the streets here, where they said that if that had been passed on by Facebook, then it may have changed the nature of the investigation against him. But, you know, you're looking at Massoud 2010, 7 years ago, you know, again, you know, tenuous link. You have to sort of assess what's coming in and put your resources where the greatest risk is. And as Mark Rowley pointed out earlier this month, 13 attacks have been, serious attacks have been foiled in the last 3 years.
Well, that's an interesting aspect of this, because I do feel that the security services and police are unfairly treated some ways in the wake of these attacks, because we don't hear about the operations that do succeed in preventing these attacks when they take place. And obviously, relative to France especially, you know, the security services, whether it's a combination of the efforts of the security services and luck, but we have actually been relatively unscathed in the scheme of things. Do you think the security services require more resources? And if so, what exactly are those resources that they require more of in order to be able to provide a more comprehensive, or run a more comprehensive strategy when it comes to this threat?
Well, I think with the workload that's coming in, last year it was announced that the security service MI5 and the secret intelligence service MI6 and GCHQ are going to have a recruitment campaign over the next few years to increase their numbers. And it's about now, and over the last 12 months, police forces have slowly but surely started to recruit again after the austerity cuts. But counter-terrorism resources and that, certainly in the policing front, hasn't really diminished. But of course, the workload's increased. So while you've not increased your number of staff, you've increased the amount of work that they're having to carry out. So hopefully we will see more staff put into that. But as regards any other measures, I mean, the UK has very comprehensive anti-terror laws. The Investigatory Powers Act was enacted at the end of last year to give wider powers of surveillance. So anything that's a more sophisticated type of attack, normally the more sophisticated, the more people involved, and therefore the more people involved, inevitably there's more communication between them, and that's easier to pick up than one individual like we saw with Massoud or anyone else who, for some unknown reason, just decides to carry out an attack as we saw last Wednesday.
Now, there's always a tension, isn't there, in these types of situations, on these issues, between civil liberties and security. In the wake of this attack, we've had UK Home Secretary Amber Rudd calling for tech companies to allow intelligence services to access various encrypted systems. WhatsApp was particularly mentioned. Where do you stand on this issue, David, given your profession, but also you're obviously a member of the public and you have a stake in civil liberties? Do you think we have the balance right in the UK right now, or do you think it needs to change?
No, I think we have it right. I mean, obviously, I'm sort of researching and I've written in this area. It's about getting the balance right between the interests of national security and rights and liberties. And, of course, in most of these cases, when we talk about communications, it's data protection. I mean, I've looked at the Investigatory Powers Act. There are sufficient safeguards there, but we have to get that balance. We have to give our intelligence services and the police these wide powers to deal, not just with terrorism, but organised crime, because that's also linked to it. But what I find frustrating is that internet service and communication service providers tend to have this reticence to pass on information, but they'll do it for paedophiles, but why not terrorists, you know?
What's their reasoning for that? Have they come up with a reason, or one that you at least find convincing or compelling, or are they just basically, as you say, not interested in cooperating?
No, I think that there is an interest in cooperation, and I think the trouble is it's having human eyes looking at these things. There are algorithms, and to be fair, Twitter, Facebook, and a few other providers have said where they've spotted, or the algorithms have picked up certain keywords, sites have been removed. And to be fair to Twitter, I mean, Islamic Daesh was very active with the use of Twitter to get its message out, and a high number of accounts were being closed every day. But of course, as quickly as one was closed, another one was opened up again. They had backup accounts. So to be fair, they have been trying. And then I also understand why encryption is important. I mean, okay, we look at Amber Rudd, she's talking about WhatsApp. But encryption is to protect all of us against being hacked. So we have to get the balance right. But what I'm saying is perhaps more human eyes monitor these algorithms, picking these things up and passing that information on.
David, we'll stop there for a short break. Don't go anywhere. Join us right after this. Hard Facts. Welcome back to the second half of this episode of Hard Facts. I'm discussing the events in London at Westminster, the horrific events where five people were murdered, 40 injured, seven seriously, as a result of a so-called lone wolf terrorist attack. Before we get back to our discussion, earlier we hit the streets to find out what the public thinks. We asked, what are the root causes of terrorist attacks, such as the one that took place in London? Let's have a listen.
Obviously, it's awful what happened yesterday, but at the same time, you know, we're bombing their countries.
It seems like a retaliation for, you know, decades of meddling with issues within the Middle East. Like, as far as we can remember, we've always intervened, not necessarily, you know, with any sort of justification.
There's ideological differences, and they obviously have a problem with the West and the Western world, and so perhaps maybe we need to look into our history a bit and take a little bit of responsibility.
Attaching yourself to a belief, it seems you're part of community when you're coming over here and you don't have that connection, you don't have any of your family necessarily, and so when you've got a group of people who are uniting under the same kind of banner or something, then it's quite easy to become involved and influenced very quickly by online campaigns.
Yeah, I think it's all to do with identity and feeling wanted somewhere. And it's not necessarily, sounds weird to say, but not necessarily a malicious thing, but more like a manipulation of ideas, and actually the way in which it's been dealt with probably hasn't been the best way as well, because it definitely ostracises certain groups of people and certain nationalities and races, and then it just promotes the problem. A lot of it is kind of to do with the idea of, like, one side versus another, like us versus them, and like making someone the other and that kind of stuff. And it's,
and we've been involved in so many root causes that are found in the Middle East. We're always involved. If it's us or America, we seem to try and get ourselves involved just because for like economic gain or political power. And so we've manipulated that area so badly, I think, that we do have to take responsibility in some way.
Well, interesting range of views, very informed views, I have to say. David, a lot of people connecting this attack and other attacks like them, by extension, with UK foreign policy in this instance. Now, this is a debate that's been ongoing since the war in Iraq in 2003. People on who support that war consistently deny any linkage. I was against that war. I think it was a disaster, and I do think it opened the gates of hell when it comes to the eruption of this sick ideology. Now, this individual, Massoud, was British-born. He was born in Kent, I believe. But however, he has latched on to perhaps grievances stemming from our foreign policy, some may say opportunistically, but certainly that's there. And this is something I think we need to nail down, because I mentioned the importance of the multicultural aspect of our society. And let's be honest, we're talking about the Muslim community. There is, on the periphery of the Muslim community, a danger of radicalisation. It's not any other community at this point, it's the Muslim community. But it is utterly reprehensible to try and assert that there is some inherent impulse within the Muslim community or the Islamic religion that gives rise to such terrorist attacks. That's the same as saying in the 1970s there was some sort of inherent impulse within the Irish community that gave rise to the IRA. There are definite, concrete, historical and political factors that are at play here when it comes to these attacks. What are your thoughts on that connection? Do you think that there is a strong connection, or do you think it's overstated?
It's a little bit of both for me. I mean, big lesson in Iraq, I think that the classic lesson was, what was the plan B? Plan A was to get rid of Saddam Hussein and his regime, and there was no plan B, and I think there was that power vacuum in both the US and the UK forces there, so in particular the US, who went up into the Anbar province and in that region there, found out that you have to have a plan B. What are you going to do to help for the infrastructure, the economic, social infrastructure, etc.? And it was similar with Libya, with the removal of Gaddafi. There's now a power vacuum there, and Libya's a mess. Let's not lose sight of that one. So I think you've got to work at, and hopefully, I really am hoping and praying that for both Iraq, when Mosul falls, really you're going to geographically see the end of Daesh in Iraq. It'll be, I mean, you're talking desert wasteland if they have control of anything there. Yet hopefully the Peshmerga forces and all the allies working with the Iraqi army can come up with some solution to have stability in that country. And then there will be a responsibility of those Western states who support that regime, the current regime, in helping them rebuild. Now, Syria, of course, is a different matter. You've got different factions fighting each other. For me, there was a tinge of sadness when the Vienna talks broke down during the Obama presidency towards the end there. Because my big hope was that finally the US-led coalition and the Russian one would finally work together to bring about the end of both Daesh and Jabhat, or now called Jabhat al-Sham. They were the al-Nusra Front.
Yes. And I mean, the world was crying out for this unity to take place. I mean, I made the point in my introduction about the fact that we're deployed hundreds of British soldiers to Estonia at the same time as Russian troops are in Syria fighting alongside their Syrian and Iranian counterparts against the very ideology responsible for the attack in Westminster. I mean, it really is cognitive dissonance, isn't it? It has to be.
Yeah, I think one reluctance about both the UK and the US at the moment putting troops in the ground, infantry troops and the likes on the ground, is what's happened in Afghanistan and Iraq. You know, trying to give air support, but yeah, I think you need a bit more than just air support. I think you need to try and get some compromise because, okay, fair enough, there are different positions and different interests in Syria. Clearly, most Western states are against the al-Assad regime, where he's been an ally for Russia. And I understand Russia's wanting to preserve the al-Assad regime because there's an important naval base there, But surely we can look beyond that. Let's look at the suffering that the ordinary citizens have had to have.
And let's be honest, there is no moral equivalence. As much as you may decry the Assad government, there is no moral equivalence with a secular government that is not calling for indiscriminate terrorist attacks to be carried out in Britain and France and America, is not preparing such attacks as a government that can ultimately be negotiated with and is presiding over a multicultural, multi-ethnic, multi-religious society. It just beggars belief that that thinking is absent. And I think it's because there's a geopolitical element to this that is getting in the way of concerted, effective foreign policy when it comes to the Middle East. But if I could just quickly move on, because you mentioned, and rightly so, that Daesh is on the way to being defeated. Mosul is on the way to being liberated. It's losing ground in Syria. We're talking about the an assault to take Raqqa being imminent. But defeating Daesh and defeating Nusra and all these other Salafi jihadist groups is one thing. But defeating the ideology is another challenge entirely. And it seems to me that the only way to defeat an idea is with another idea. And this is when it comes to the element of alienation that's involved in these attacks, that young men who either convert to Islam, and let's be absolutely accurate, we're talking about a very radicalised peripheral interpretation of Sunni Islam. But is it peripheral? I mentioned the Saudis. This is connected to Wahhabism, which is a very literal interpretation of Islam that goes back to the 7th century when these Wahhabi clerics, who are state-funded, Wahhabism is a state religion in Saudi Arabia, are preaching on a weekly basis that we should be slaughtering infidels and apostates and unbelievers. You could make it up. And that we're sitting down and supping with the Saudi regime in the West, selling them billions of pounds worth of arms. This surely is another contradiction in our foreign policy, David, isn't it?
Well, it's one of those things where, I mean, I was talking there about Syria, about working together. I think rather than continue condemning other states, try and work with them. And certainly those in the Gulf states, it's better to be talking and working with them than continually condemning them. And I'm quite sure behind closed doors when Western leaders, like when Theresa May was in the Gulf recently for a security summit, I'm quite sure, and I hope behind closed doors, there are discussions about what you've just been mentioning there. But you have to look at groups like Daesh and that. I mean, you were saying earlier, they're not Islamic. You know,
they
just aren't. I mean, this group has killed more Muslims than anyone else in their campaign of terror, be it based in the Middle East or outside. They are ruthless. They're quite happy to try and commit genocide against the Yazidis.
And it's Muslims who are doing most of the fighting against them in the Middle East.
Precisely. And I think some people lose sight. That's quite sad when I hear in the UK people sort of condemning Muslims and Islam. You know, and I remember a couple of years ago, 36 senior Muslim clerics wrote an open letter to Daesh and saying, what you're doing is not Islamic and you are not a state. What you're doing is not in our name. But this doesn't seem to get reported in some the media resource, in particular some of the print media, which is a shame because, you know, you mentioned earlier, I remember the Irish Troubles only too well, and being a British-born Roman Catholic with an Irish background, I understood fully what that campaign was about. But, you know, I ended up in the police sort of trying to deal with that. You know, it's so easy to label and point a finger, but, you know, let's look at what the bigger picture is. And as you rightly said, John, this is a small faction. And the number of converts who don't even know about Islam, you know, the white converts, whatever they've been, they don't really understand it. And they think they're now Muslim, but they're not. You're either Daesh, Al-Qaeda, or
something else. It's something else. But despite that, the ideology is out there, David. How do we defeat it?
This is going to be difficult to kill an ideology. I mean, I sort of look at some of the far right, and the UK was the first state to prescribe, I'd make a terrorist group of a far right group, National Action. And National Action are still espousing National Socialism from the 1930s. Okay, they're small in number, but it's very difficult to totally eradicate an ideology. But you're right, John. Let's have an alternative. Let's give people an alternative.
Give them some hope.
Yes, precisely.
Now, do you believe that the media goes too far in reporting these outrages? Do you think it actually helps to give oxygen to the people involved, gives them a sense of importance, fame, and so on? Or do you think the media has got it right? Or clearly the media has to report it. Nobody's saying they should not. But sometimes I feel there's a sort of an hysteria unleashed because in the scheme of things, it's the odds of being caught up in one of these attacks are infinitesimal, aren't they? Do you believe the media goes too far in reporting these events and fanning the flames of this kind of a collective hysteria and every time these occur?
Well, I sort of split the media up into different factions. There's the print media in the sense where papers are owned by that have owners with a certain view. And then you have like TV and radio, like we're talking now. I think when you have an incident that's serious, I think it does require coverage. And of course, news media has changed so much now. We have 24-hour news. You will have different outlets. So not so much in competition, but making sure that they're up to date in their reporting. But you look at last Wednesday, I mean, now it's obviously most of the 24-hour news channels are not giving it all the coverage it was, but it was important. And of course, we can't get around the fact that any group, I mean, that was the Palace of Westminster trying to carry out an attack there, was going to get international media attention. So it should, like we saw with Paris and so on. So it is important that there is some form of coverage. But what's important is, and what I did notice, certainly with TV and radio, was a more balanced coverage. They were actually putting in where you have, I mean, today there's women holding hands across Westminster Bridge, including Muslims, things like that. That was really important, but you don't really get that in the print media. I think the print media, and certainly what's
sensationalist, and they have a political agenda. David, we've run out of time. We'll have to leave it there, I'm afraid. Thank you very much for coming on the show with your expertise and insights. Thank you most of all for listening. Until next time, remember, the only facts worth taking seriously are hard facts.